right, we're coming back for the last round today. As always, I'm your host and book ambassador, Zachary Wolf, and here we have Charles Stern reading from his book. Go ahead.
Well, I'm going to read chapter 4, and so because I'm going to read chapter 4, I'll just give you a little bit of a background. There's three main characters in chapter 4. The first one is the cat, Algernon, who spends a lot of time in his basement underworld, and he competes with Carl, the husband, for the attention of his wife, Grace. And Grace spends a lot of time in her bathroom lair, and she's been irritated with her husband because he's had to spend so much time at work. He's had to spend evenings and weekends and so forth at work, and so she's mad, and they've been having arguments. So when he's on his way home from work, he's anticipating leaving one stress and heading toward another one when he gets home. However, when he gets home, he's in the garage, and he hears some odd music. He falls asleep for a minute, wakes up, goes into the house expecting a fight, but it turns out his wife is completely different. She's positive, she's accommodating, and so forth. They have a great time, they have some great sex, they fall asleep. He wakes up, goes into another room, sits down at a desk, and starts to write. He wants to write a love letter because he's so happy. But he hears that music again, falls asleep. It's chapter 4, Carl's writing. Carl Otto slowly emerged into the state of alert sensibility and gradually realized that his face was flattened with his left cheek down on the desk. There was some drool. He wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. The clock said 5:59 a.m. He didn't remember dozing off. The cat was nowhere to be seen. There was a crick in his neck, and he rubbed it hard. His right arm was numb, and he had dropped his pen. He surmised that the discomfort was from the unusual sleeping position and shook his arm to regain circulation. He looked down at the legal pad. There was one word, grief. Grief? What the heck? I was writing a love letter. He tore the sheet off and crumpled it up into a tight ball, tighter than necessary, and dropped it into a trash can. He felt a strong urge to drain last night's beer. He abandoned the desk, got up, feeling the rust in his knees. He was the Tin Man after such an uncomfortable snooze. I need oil, he said, whispering in a mock scream. But this definitely isn't Oz. The gold from the Yellow Brick Road was cashed in years ago. He smiled at his own joke, but no one else, even the audience in his own head, least of all the cat, found it amusing. After he amused himself, he hobbled to the half bath near the front door so he wouldn't disturb Grace. She needed her sleep, and she needed to be fresh for work later. Carl Otto washed his hands, slouched, stumbled toward the bedroom. He wanted to look at Grace while she slept. Somehow, usually, it made him feel relaxed and warm towards her. Maybe it was the look of relaxation on her face when she slept. Maybe it was the look of angelic innocence and vulnerability. Maybe it made him feel protective of her. He wasn't sure, but he wanted to experience it. He peered into the dark room. When his eyes began to adjust, he realized that Grace wasn't in the bed. In fact, there was no sign of her. He flipped a light switch by the door. There was no indentation on her pillow, and her side of the bed showed no sign that she had slept there. He checked the bathroom, but she wasn't in her sacred lair. He said, Grace? There was no answer. He yelled, Grace? No answer. He wandered around the house looking for her, but she wasn't in any of the rooms. She wasn't down in Algernon's underworld either. Where could she have gone? She didn't need to be at work until 9 o'clock. Carl went into the bedroom again. The bed was still empty. The clock in the nightstand shouted, it's 6:15 a.m. Maybe she went to work early. Maybe she remembered something she had to do and had to get there early to complete it. She probably wouldn't have wanted to wake me up. He noticed her closet door seemed to be open about 6 inches. It invited him to examine its contents. He walked over and slid it open all the way. He stood there, mouth agape, his eyes uncontrollably blinking. There were only a few bare hangers. No clothes? What the hell's happening? He sat down hard in the dumbfounded bed, confused and disoriented. No clothes? No clothes, he repeated to himself aloud, shaking his head in bewilderment. How can there be no clothes? He asked as though he was expecting an answer. There was no reply. The force of his desperate question escaped the room and then the house and headed out to eventually fill the universe. Even the universe was silent on the matter. Algernon sauntered into the room, investigating the ruckus, sat in the middle of the floor, and stared at his clueless competition. Carl Otto slowly shook his head, trying to relieve himself of the panic ignited by his confusion. What could have happened? We had such a great time last night. He buried his head in his frustrated and confused palms. Why would she leave? For that matter, how could she have taken all of her belongings without me hearing her in the space of less than 4 hours? Did she pack everything up and put it in the car before I got home last night? If she planned to leave, why would she have been so uncharacteristically loving and accommodating sexually last night? Why did she sound so loving, so happy to see me? Was all of that a compensatory goodbye gesture? He sat on the silent bed, their bed, the bed where they had been having wild and fantastic sex just a few hours ago, the bed that had cradled them together nearly every night for over 25 years. He sat there feeling stunned and for a very long time, a rigid statue. He didn't know how long the eternal blankness lasted before he stirred. What's happening? He heard himself ask, the image reflected in Grace's vanity mirror sitting stoically across from him. He made a gesture of helpless inquiry, but there was no answer forthcoming. Just the shake of the reflective head that mimicked his own. But oddly, the meaning seemed subtly incongruous. It was the same movement, except left-handed. It was less like his own, I don't know, and more like, don't ask. He didn't notice Algernon climbing onto the bed and nestling up to him. He stared at his reflection in the mirror for a minute longer, feeling numb and blank. The entire world had come to a momentary halt before he felt the earth begin to rotate again. He went to the garage, and Grace's car was gone. He lifted his shoulders in disbelief, unconsciously spread his hands wide in total confusion and helplessness. It was as if they were saying, what the hell is this? He dropped his arms abruptly and his shoulders slouched and surrendered to his confusion. How is this even possible? It's been over 3.5 hours, maybe 4, since I sat down in that chair to write. Everything in his life seemed out of control, and worst of all, he didn't know what he was doing. Didn't he write grief on the pad without knowing it? It frightened him to think that he didn't always have conscious control over what he did. There seemed to be forces outside of his conscious awareness at work. And speaking of not being in control of things, where is the least controllable thing in my life? Grace. Well, next to the cat. He sat dumbstruck for what seemed and felt like a lifetime. Flashback memories of his life with Grace engulfed his gray matter, seeped into the white, and permeated his whole existence. His head was vibrating, and his vision blurred under a furrowed brow. Standing on the confused precipice of time, peering out over the vista of his past, he swooned. He silently struggled to regain his balance, his sanity, if he had any left. He sat in a heap of sad defeat. I have to wake up. I need some coffee. Maybe I'm caught in a dream. He went to the kitchen and put a pod in the coffee maker and retrieved the mug from the dishwasher. He rummaged mindlessly through the pile of mail and random papers that accumulated on the kitchen counter, calling him and trying to distract him. It was where Grace usually left it. She almost never looked through it. She mostly left that inglorious task to him. She seemed to treat this stuff like objects of no consequence, despite the necessary bills that screamed out like the carnivorous plant in the Little Shop of Horrors. Feed me, demanding payment for his life's blood. There were several bills intermixed with various advertisements. There was an envelope from an insurance company and another from a funeral home. He tore open the one from the insurance company. It read, "We are in receipt of your letter notifying us of your wife Grace Otto's untimely passing. In order to complete your request, an original death certificate and the police report must be received. The original documents will be returned to you within a week of receipt." The funeral home letter stated that Grace had been cremated, and they awaited his instructions whether to FedEx the ashes to him or would he prefer to pick them up in person. There was also a bill for the procedure, along with condolences for his loss and an obvious form letter preprinted on the company's letterhead. What's this? Grace died? She's dead? I just had sex with her last night and we had a great talk. Another envelope had the death certificate in it. Finally, there was an envelope from the police department that contained the police report. The cover letter simply stated, "Please find and close the police report you requested." It said that Grace had died in a car crash months ago. "Just the facts, ma'am," he muttered to the envelope. The envelope offered no response except a teardrop that moistened one small spot. Carl Otto felt confused and overwhelmed. He didn't have the energy to read on. He slammed the mail down on the unforgiving counter. He felt drained and fatigued. He noticed that his legs were quivering. He steadied himself on the counter. Was I asleep for over 3 hours? Or was I asleep for months? He abandoned his coffee. He felt emotionally exhausted and decided to lie down. But he didn't want to lay on their bed. He headed for the couch, leaving a trail of confused sorrow in his wake. His entire weight landed on the unsuspecting couch. A seismic tremor of magnitude 10 shook the structure, and objects began to fall from the shelves in his mind. His brain began to hurt in the aftershocks. He was so dazed, and he was too dazed to cry or accept that Grace was not only gone, but dead. He had anticipated her loss through divorce, but not this. How could I forget that she's gone, dead? There had to have been a funeral or a memorial and letters and phone calls from the insurance company and friends and family and her workplace and who knows what else. Both their parents were gone. There would only have been the kids and friends there. There was that music again. It surrounded him. He was infused with the all-consuming sleep. His last thought was, "I've got to check that noise. Is that the furnace or is that the radio alarm?"
Intense. So can you tell us a bit about your inspiration for this story, where some of this came from, the characters perhaps?
Well, the cat is cats that I've known. He has quite a personality if you read the book. I don't know, I just started writing. I just had an idea about, the book actually has two main characters, John Doe and Carl Otto, but the first chapter is John Doe. So there's two different people and every other chapter, not quite, but almost every other chapter is John Doe, Carl, John Doe, Carl. But so I had to, I had the idea of John Doe, who goes to a community mental health program because he can't remember who he is. That's why they call him John Doe. Mm. And I'm a psychologist, so I'm used to, you know, treating people. So I started thinking about somebody going to a place like that. And, you know, it sort of bloomed from there, I guess you'd say. I was inspired by magic realism authors like Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who had won the Nobel Prize for literature at one point, and wrote the 100 Years of Solitude that maybe some people know of, but also by the Japanese author Haruki Murakami. He wrote Kafka on the Shore and a number of other books, and also Isabel Allende. But a lot of these people that write in that genre are from other countries, you know, from South America, Japan, and so forth. And so I had read 100 Years of Solitude many years ago, and I read Murakami's Kafka on the Shore, and then I ended up reading all the ones I could get from those authors. And that's, I just liked it so much that I wanted to try to write something along that line. And so in magic realism, it's not science fiction, and it's not fantasy exactly, although you could do it with fantasy or science fiction, but the thing about it is that things happen, and you know what happens, but you really don't usually know why it happened. You know, there's not a deep, like in a science fiction novel, you would get lots of scientific explanations for why things happen, something like that, or fantasies, you get a lot of things like the background of why things happen. But a lot of times in magic realism. Certain things happen in a regular story, but you don't know why. So that's the magic part of it. I had never written fiction before, so I just wanted to try it.
So do you have at home?
I've never read out loud like this either.
Do you have at home, like on a wall somewhere, a large storyboard so that you can keep track of what's going on in your story?
No.
Just makes sense in your head.
I just start writing, and then I get quite a few chapters later, and I write something. I got to reconnect that, and I go back and connect it to an earlier chapter. I guess instead of the way I do it isn't. I mean, if I write a lot longer book, I probably have to have some kind of outline. But the thing about it is, what I do instead of an outline is I have sort of like principles, I suppose you would say, of magic realism. So the idea about there's going to be these magical things happen, and people move back and forth between realities, but it's not like the science fiction kind of thing. I have these basic ideas, and then I have an idea for a story, and I just fit that all into it.
So your process is kind of in between the outlining and free flow.
I can't say it's exactly an outline, but I have a structure in my mind that are sort of like principles about how to approach it. But like I said, if it was a lot longer book, I'd probably have to have an outline because it's hard to keep track if you have a really long book with lots of characters.
Right. Yes?
Question mark.
Well, I've...
In a fictional sense?
Well, I've drawn from personal experiences, experiences working with patients over the years, friends, family, things like that. Like Carl Otto, for example. My grandfather's name was Otto Carl. So, and his wife, my grandmother's name was Grace.
Interesting.
So,
did you take more than just the names?
I mean, his last name was Stern, but...
For those characters?
I'm sorry?
Did you take more than just the names for those characters? Are there personality traits in there, too?
Their personality traits aren't so much in there, but I just use their names. But the characters are more like people I've known or patients or from my own personal experiences, things like that. It's kind of all mixed together.
So you fictionalized it. You saw yourself as the practitioner without using actual characters or their personality traits. Anything that you might be treating in each of these individuals, but you have this, you use this as a framework for your fiction.
Yes.
That's what I'm seeing here.
Yeah.
Because you're talking about two different people. They're unrelated to each other.
Well, that you'll have to find out.
You have to read the book.
People start reading and they say, oh, I've got it figured out. And then they tell me what they figured out, and it's not quite what they figured out. So, the book comes to an end, and then it comes to another end at the end. So so it's not easy to figure out what's happening, really, even though people start thinking they've got it, but they don't.
And that's part of your job, too. It's not having difficulty trying to figure out what's going on within one individual.
Right. So a lot of my, I try to, like you can maybe see in this particular chapter, but that maybe I try to express what's going on inside people. You know, their feelings, their thoughts, their behaviors, and so forth. And I also try to look for things like a contrast. You start off with Carl and his wife being, having lots of trouble and lots of stress going on between them and stress at work and all that. And then suddenly it's just a total opposite thing. There's a big contrast. And I try to do that with emotions and all that. Because he's all excited about something, and then it turns out to be a different thing, and so on. So there's there's lots of different kinds of contrasts in the book. Other chapters is probably even more.
As NASA might say, we have a situation here.
I really liked how you were talking about showing how the characters are feeling and thinking instead of just kind of an external view on them. And I really liked how in that chapter you kind of put this into a real thing, like describing his gestures in a very realistic way so that, you know, it was very easy to see what was going on.
Well, I try to paint the picture as best I can for people to kind of, I'm pretty visual, so I try to make it so people can kind of picture it in their minds, you know, in enough detail. But I've also read some books in the past where they didn't do a whole lot of that. They just told the story. It's kind of boring.
Yeah, you run into that sometimes where the authors will just kind of tell you what's going on. But
yeah.
It's, you've got a lot of great imagery in there. Have you ever sketched out a scene or just a single image in your head to kind of give it a tangible form?
Well, I do that as I'm writing, but there are times when I'll be, I don't know, listening to the radio at a movie or whatever, and I will and I will get an idea, you know, and I'll write it down or try to remember it so that I can write it down later. And it's hard to write in a new movie theater. But, you know, I have tried to do that. I've tried to do it. It's a little bit messy, and sometimes I have, what did I write? I can't remember. But so sometimes I will get an idea like that, and then I will later on incorporate it and say, oh, that would fit right into this spot in the book. You know. So,
it's got a fantastic cover.
Yes,
one of my favorites in Grey Wolf. Is that your own design?
No, I can't take any credit for it, except to accept it. The designer did a great job, and I thought it's perfect for what the book is. And,
so you didn't offer any ideas? Say maybe I kind of want it to look like
well,
this?
Well, I offered some possible ideas, but what
that's
she came up with
them.
was just great. So I didn't, it looks good to me. I didn't go through 16. It's one.
Yes?
You said this was your first book of fiction. Have you written books of nonfiction or other types?
Well, I'm a PhD, so I had to write a dissertation, and I've, you know, I had, you know, master's theses, and I've had to write, you know, those kind of things, and I've, you know, lots of reports and all that, you know, academic stuff or professional stuff. But I've never really written fiction much. I you know, dabbled a little. Tiny little short story here and there throughout my, you know, life, but nothing, you know, like this. And I quit working at a clinic that I was working at about 2 years ago, so I had a little extra time. I mean, I'm very busy, but I decided to carve out some time on Wednesday nights. I'll go to Panera and have dinner and write, and that's where I ran into the Grey Wolf folks. And they said, you know, Diana and I think it was Evelyn, were walking by, what are you doing? I'm writing, whatever. And they said, well, you know, we're publishers, so.
So you were already there.
Yeah, I was already there, but I was writing. I was only doing it for myself. I wasn't, you know, expecting publication or anything. Mm-hmm. Everybody I had spoken to in the past who had written novels never got anything published. So I was just doing it because I wanted something creative to do. Whatever, and I also get up early and go to a coffee shop in the morning most mornings, and I will prepare. I do a lot of expert witness stuff in court, so I'll go and prepare for court if I have court that day. I usually do most days, and then if I have any time after that, maybe a half hour or something, I will work on writing. So it's just what happened. I just started writing and ran into a publisher, and I'm terrible at grammar and all that, so I appreciate all the help I can get with that kind of stuff. I had the worst elementary and junior high education, imagine. My teachers were not good teachers like you guys. They were terrible. I think one was psychotic now that I think about it, but anyway.
He'll be in the next book.
But a lot of my teachers were the same teachers my mother had, so I, you know, was going to...
Do you find that there's a certain place or time that you really get your creative, your muse hits you, so to speak?
I can't say there's any particular time. It just hits me. I just, you know, get an idea and write it down. I've got a whole thing full of notes, and I'll go through them. And, you know, like the one I'm working on right now, I'll story I'm writing. And it's, you know, oh, yeah, this would be good, or this, ah, this doesn't fit this story, that kind of thing. So, oh, yes.
You write with the Panera Group, did I hear you say that?
I go there most Wednesday nights, yeah.
Do you find that difficult, writing with other people around?
You know, most of the time it's not a problem for me, I can focus pretty well, but there are times when I'll be trying to work on a particular section or sentence even, and it's, I'm having trouble with it, and I'll have to, you know, do that to just, you know. But I do have ear plugs that I can use. Once in a while I do it. Depends if I'm particularly sensitive to what's going on around me. I haven't done it very often, but once in a while I've done that, and it cuts down.
Do you ever find yourself in the group writing setting and kind of lean over to somebody else and say, hey, can you, what do you think about this, or get your input while you're there?
Sometimes I have questions, and I'll ask Diana.
Source from the group that you're in?
Sometimes I'll have questions, and I'll ask Diana or Evelyn or somebody, but most of the time I just hunker down and write. But I'm not opposed to having some social time, but I did set that time aside to write, so I do that most of the time, although I do sometimes socialize a little or ask questions or, you know, whatever.
What can we look forward to next? Any other
projects?
Well,
I submitted another one that I don't know if, I don't think Diana's read it yet or anybody.
I'm 4 chapters in.
Oh, okay. So I don't know if it's publishable yet, but
from what I've seen so far, it is.
Okay. Well, thank you. Appreciate that. So it'll take some edits and whatever, but the title, at least the title I gave it so far, unless that needs to change, is Finder in Hell World, a Love Story.
Oh.
Now, did you come up with the title before content? I mean, or did you kind of write it up?
Juxtaposition Paradox, I came up with about halfway through the book. Finder in Hell World, I came up with Finder in Hell World before I even started writing the damn thing.
Oh, there you
go. But it got to the point where the main two characters, the male and female characters, you know, it became a love story, so I added the love story by the time I got done. So, yeah, so anyway.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Juxtaposition Paradox.
Thank you.
On sale at graywolfpublishing.com.
Don't apologize, buy books.
And thank you, everyone, for coming out. This has been a wonderful evening.